This week on Best in Show, Oppenheimer's editor Jennifer Lame spills on working with Christopher Nolan and Greta Gerwig and Noah Baumbach and Ari Aster, and the editor behind our four favorites videos spills his four editing faves of 2023. But first, this week's episode is brought to you by us, Letterboxd Showtimes. Now on Letterboxd for patron members and coming to all members on Christmas Eve, we have Showtimes. Members in the US, Canada, UK and Ireland, New Zealand, and Australia now have the ability to discover where films are currently playing in cinemas near them.
It's so exciting, Mia. Created in collaboration with the aggregator Assemble, the new Showtimes feature provides access to real-time information about film screenings over the coming 7 days. In the United States alone, Assemble indexes approximately 9,000 screens. And yes, I have made sure that my local art house also has Showtimes. It's out now for patrons and coming to all members in those regions Christmas Eve and to more Letterboxd members in more places in the future. Yay, cinema!
Welcome to Best in Show, a limited podcast series brought to you by The Letterboxd Show. I am Mia Livaccino, the West Coast editor here at Letterboxd, and Best in Show is all about awards season. Throughout the series, we are discussing the noms and gongs, the snubs and surprises in cinema history, and we're also letting the Letterboxd data tell us why the voters were right or a little bit misguided. We also meet contenders from this year's movies and interrogate insiders about the film ecosystem. Mostly, we do what we always do here at Letterboxd. Celebrate cinema. And here again to celebrate cinema with me are my Best in Show besties, Hollywood veteran and our editorial producer, Brian Formo.
Howdy, partners.
And our editor-in-chief, Gemma Gracewood.
G'day.
As this episode goes to air, the 96th Academy Awards shortlists have been officially announced. 15 films have been shortlisted for the International Feature and Documentary Feature categories, and the animation list is also out. Our newsletter editor, George Fenwick, has all the details on our awards HQ and in your inboxes. But Brian, with your Hollywood insider cap and Oscars ready rented tux on, could you give us a quick recap of what these shortlists are all about?
The shortlists do what none of us Letterboxd obsessives can do, which is like shorten the amount of things to watch. Essentially, so this is these shortlists, it's the international films, the documentaries, the shorts, the songs, visual effects, makeup, hairstyles. Those are all whittled down by boards of people with expertise to manageable, reviewable size for the very busy, busy people who make movies. So it's taking down the 110 possibilities down to 15 so the voters have a chance to watch them all before their votes are due, because they're due soon. January 11th, actually.
That's really soon.
Yes, yes.
So that's why, yeah, get it down to 15. Get it down to 15 to 5. There you go.
Yes, and very, very, very soon, as promised, we do have our feature interview with Oppenheimer editor Jennifer Lame. But first, I do want to know from my besties, what was the awards level film that first alerted you to the craft of editing, whether you knew that that's what you were watching or not? And how can you tell that it's editing that you're watching?
As opposed to like the shots or, you know, yeah, right. Well, look, as someone who adores editors, Mia, because they do what I cannot, I actually think we need an editor in this discussion. Luckily, we have one. For the past year, Letterboxd has had our own secret snipping weapon. A filmmaker, he is a filmmaker who makes a movie a month. Can you believe it? A movie a month. And in between those epic achievements, he deigns to be our own in-house editor. All those four faves and last four watches and other great goodies you see on our socials, they've been crafted into a house style by the genius we know as AJ.
Hello, I've been here the whole time.
As AJ. Quiet as an editor yes. should be.
Yes, exactly, exactly. I know my place. Yeah.
This is very exciting for me because I get to see AJ. I'm usually just typing notes to AJ all the time. But I get to see his face, hear his voice, Here he is.
Here I am.
And I can't believe that this is also our first official meeting face-to-face, because I feel like you already know me so well, because you were very, very privy to the very vulnerable raw footage of my interviews.
Oh, yeah. I haven't met almost any of you guys in real life, but I feel like deep personal connections with all of you. But it's all parasocial, which is that's the life of an editor, I think, is feeling like your best friends don't really know you're there.
but you're looking at us like, you must just get to know our tics. You're like, oh, here it comes. Gemma's going to do the thing, the wheezy laugh or whatever.
Oh, God. And you're like, oh, Christ, Mia's showing her opening night tattoo again. So because you're our editor guy, what do you love about editing Four Favorites, besides seeing all of our bloopers?
I love editing Four Favorites because you can tell a lot about a person by what they say are their Four Favorites. And that's fun for when it's community Four Favorites. When it's celebrity Four Favorites, I feel like I'm being given the keys to, like, the kingdom of what these super famous people are like. And I think that one of the best things about Four Favorites is when people are able to distinguish between best films ever and your four favorites. Like, you know, everyone's always like, oh my God, four, how could I ever pick four? And it's like, that's a great number because it forces you to choose, I think. And I don't know, like, I feel like from my perspective, you know, I have all these people telling me what their four favorite films are all the time. And I feel like it sometimes feels like a new canon of best films ever is being made. Like, I feel like 10 years ago, you'd get a film like The Devil Wears Prada is popular with people who like it. Now I'm convinced it's like one of the best movies ever made because people are always like mentioning it in the same breath as like Apocalypse Now. And maybe it should be, you know, I'm all about like dismantling what we consider to be good art and bad art. And I think there is such clout to having a Four Favorites, which tells four different aspects of a person. And I think it gives a richer letterboxed profile when you are saying that your favorite film is Like a Cheerleader or Help, I'm a Cheerleader, right? Or
But I'm a Cheerleader.
But I actually haven't seen it, and I was going to mention, I do have another, I have a Letterboxd list for super famous movies I'd never heard of before I started working for Letterboxd, and but I'm a Cheerleader is on there. But yeah, I think like people are always arguing like, oh, do I want Good Godfather 1 or 2 in my four favorite? It's like, yeah, yeah, yeah. But then when Rachel Sonneau is like, Saved is one of her four favorites, I'm like, holy shit, I haven't thought about that movie in so long. That's so great. So yeah, and I get to learn about loads of movies. I'm always adding stuff to my watch list, which is, it's so wholesome, right? The system works, I guess. So whenever, you know, I'll hear someone mention a movie that I think sounds cool, I have to go to the Letterboxd page for it anyway to get the poster and whatever other information I need. And so, yeah, I get to add it to my watch list.
Yeah, so four favorites are not for short lists. It's for only making longer and longer, longer lists.
I'm creeping on your four faves right now, AJ. AJ in HD, for those listening who want to follow. We got Borat's subsequent movie film. Sequel fan there, okay. Mm-hmm. Star Trek, the motion picture. Manhunter, and then bringing us all the way back to this award season, Porco Rosso is on there, which makes me wonder, A, have you seen The Boy and the Heron? And B, of the 2023 contenders, what are your faves in terms of editing?
Sure thing. Yes, I have seen The Boy and the Heron. I saw it the other day. It was my first Miyazaki in cinema as well, which was cool. I had to think about this, like, when have I noticed editing as an editor in the last year? And my first answer is, some people are saying it's a 2023 film. I, and a lot of people, caught it in 2022. But the one that blew my mind most recently was Skinamarink, from an editing perspective. Because I watched that film, and the reviews for that film ranged from positive to, why are they filming a corner of a room for so long? But as an editor, God, the luxury to just be able to stay on a shot of nothing for 20 seconds. It made me so jealous. And I think like pacing is something that I care about a lot as an editor and as a filmmaker in general. And Skinamarink's pacing is like uninterrupted. It's no one was telling the director what he could or couldn't do. And I think it's really interesting because of that, because it really pushes past the boundaries of what like studio notes would probably allow you to do. So that was a big one for me in the last year or so. Yeah.
Four. Let's make it four. Let's make it a four favorites editing of 2023.
I have four. Look at that. These two probably don't need too much explanation, but John Wick Chapter 4 and Oppenheimer, I think, were really awesome editing. I think it's more, maybe you could argue it's more sound design, but that is part of editing. But the sound design in Oppenheimer feels like the crescendo of everything Christopher Nolan has been quite controversially playing with for this last few films. It worked for me in Oppenheimer. It did not work for me in Tenet. So it was cool to see it reach a point in which it's actually doing I'm receiving it as the filmmaker intended it, I guess. John Wick, always, like, editing's the secret king of those John Wick movies anyway, so I don't know if I need to explain too much there. But the other one I saw that I really liked this year was No One Will Save You. It's an alien invasion movie, and there's no dialogue in it, which blew my mind as it's 10 minutes in and no one's spoken yet. I was like, oh my God, like, I got it. This is exactly the kind of like experimental stuff I want. And it's the editing in that film that creates this second layer of tension. Like, there's the horror aspect, which is creating tension, but then there's also like, is someone about to say something? And that creates tension as well, and it keeps getting undercut, or something else will happen that will prevent dialogue from being spoken. And as an editor, I could see that being very fun to work out the exact cut points and where to place the rising music or things like that. So, yeah.
And Slim talked to Brian Duffield for the Letterboxd show.
Yep. Yeah.
So good. So going into Oscars voting, what are some things that you wish either Oscar voters or just everyday people in general knew about editing? What are some common misconceptions?
Well, you know the galaxy brain meme? You got everyone familiar with the galaxy brain meme? Yeah. So I feel like the smallest brain is like good editing is showy, right? And then the expanded brain is good editing is unnoticeable. And I think that's where most people are. I think most people have heard that tidbit some point in their filmmaking journey where they go, oh, well, you know, good editing shouldn't be picked up. But I think the expanded brain is, it's whatever the film needs, right? Because you can say that good editing should be unnoticeable, but then look at Everything Everywhere All at Once last year, which won Best Editing, and that editing is not unnoticeable, to say the least. But then you've got things like Bohemian Rhapsody, which had a lot of...
I was just going to say, I was going to bring up Bohemian Rhapsody and ask you your opinion on that editing. So thank you for doing it for me.
Yeah, so that's a lot. That's a lot of editing for a film that should probably have pretty unnoticeable editing, right? I think that similar to how people describe good cinematography or good acting as well, is there is no isolated example of good acting or good cinematography, because I think it is about what the director wants. You know, you look at someone like Nicolas Cage, who has been in his fair share of stinkers, but he's a really good actor in them. He's doing what the director's asking for him. Maybe it's a bad director, maybe it's not right for the film, but when he's in something good, it's the biggest film of the moment, right? I think it depends on what the film is. And so, I don't know, I'm getting a little tired of people telling me like, oh, good editing's unnoticeable, because it's like, depends what it is. Look at Everything Everywhere All at Once. Look at Spider-Verse. Look at all these films which need, it's not just nice to have, it is required to have boisterous, explosive editing in those films. And it's probably a lot of the reason why those films are good. I think editing is what I like about editing is you can turn something bad to good in the edit, and you can't really do that with any other part of the filmmaking process.
AJ, I've got a big question that your answer reminded me of. It's the one that Gemma understandably made me wait to ask so that you could answer. What was the awards level film that first alerted you to the craft of editing, whether you knew that that's what you were watching or not? So in other words, what was your editing coming of age as a movie nerd?
Yeah, cool. So I've got a small list. It's slightly more than four, which I know we will all hate, but it felt like I needed to answer the question properly, and I've ordered it from most basic to most interesting opinion. Because my first answer is Pulp Fiction, which I cringe saying. Like, I am past calling Pulp Fiction like the best movie ever. Like, that was me at 15.
We all go through it, AJ.
Exactly. And at 15, seeing that movie for the first time, non-linear narrative, et cetera, I don't need to explain why Pulp Fiction's good editing. Next down on the list is Hot Fuzz. And again, if you're an amateur filmmaker like I am, if you're a beginning filmmaker like I am, someone tells you their favorite director is Edgar Wright, you say, yeah, I know, you're a beginner filmmaker. But still, it was a massive influence for me. So we've done Tarantino and Edgar Wright. Those are the two big. Also, Wes Anderson often pops up. And I used to be a film tutor as well, so I know what beginner filmmakers are really interested in. Third, I'd say 500 Days of Summer. Again, another example of a movie I've kind of grown out of, thankfully. But that movie taught me, like, how you can incorporate so many different styles and things into a otherwise normal story, and again, non-linear narrative, and I think it's really fun and interesting. Casino Royale is next on my list. I think that's like my favorite example of a movie with normal editing. Like, it's not doing anything. It's the unnoticeable kind we were talking about before. But that movie's pacing sings. It's so interesting. It's so fun. And controversial opinion, I think it's the best James Bond movie, and I think it's weird that that's the controversial opinion. I think filmmakers should be like, yeah, obviously Casino Royale. Like it should be saying From Russia with Love. That's the, like, oh, here we go opinion. But it's not for some reason. For some reason, it's Casino Royale. I'll go through the next two in quick succession. 28 Days Later and Children of Men. Really, really grounded, gritty. Yep, films. Really, really, again, unnoticeable editing, but a little bit more complicated than something like Casino Royale.
Can I just, I know we've got to get to Jennifer Lehman. She is amazing, but mm-hmm. this does make me want to ask a question I had on the list, which is something I often see in Letterboxd reviews of one-shot films is why is there an editor credited? And it made me think of it because of that one shot in Children of Men,
exactly,
which is so famous. Mm. And it's like, why was an editor credited when there's no editing? And I'm just wondering if you would deign to discuss and perhaps plug your latest and very festive short film.
Yes, please. Thanks so much. So I don't know if everyone knows, but I have a crew called $1 Genre, where the idea is that we make a short film every month and the genre is picked by people on our Patreon who pay a dollar, so $1 Genre. Start of 2022 and finishing up our second year this year. And the last film we made was, we got one shot as the genre. And so the film is called Melissa Gillespie Audition for Unnamed Strong Female Lead. And it's presented as an audition tape from, like, a struggling actress, and then someone breaks into the house while they're still filming. Anyway, the question, why is an editor needed for a one-shot? Because, everybody, one-shots aren't real, including the ones in Children of Men, including the ones in Gravity, including the ones in all these films you can think of. I would say 90% of them, there are hidden cuts in there. And those hidden cuts...
No. Are you the Christmas Grinch of editing right now?
Maybe. I can tell you what I edit in this one shot, which is we had moments where the camera gets bumped and it swings around and we'd cut there and then start the next take on a transition. They didn't all work, so what does an editor do? An editor works out how to make whip pans work when nobody has really whip panned in a camera. Other things I had to do was you could see blood packs getting placed on the ground and things, so I had to crop them out or paste over them or things like that. In terms of editing, it is a completely different beast to just a traditionally edited film. But yeah, I mean, I heard that Children of Men's, like the one shot where they're walking through the well, they're running through the war zone, that's full of cuts, I've heard. And I mean, and it's, to me, that's not a secret. To me, that's the fun of one shot as a format. Cause like, I'm not embarrassed about saying, yeah, I've got cuts in my one shot film, because things like Birdman has obvious, like it'll pass through a dark hallway and it's like, well, yeah, why wouldn't you cut there? You know? So, editing one shots specifically is all about finding whatever semblance of an editable moment there is and exploiting that as much as you can, I think. My final film for my editing coming of age, and this is probably this is my least normie choice, but also I think probably the most influential, is Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. I think that taught me so much about editing. It almost, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang feels like a lot of it was fixed in the edit room, like with the narration and with scenes going back and forth, especially at the start. That film is so snappy and so quippy, and it's so funny, and it's because of how fast-paced it is, and what is pacing if not the marriage of directing, acting, and editing. You know?
Speaking of fast-paced, we have a grand finale mailbag question that is about that very subject. This is from Aaron Zani. Hello, Letterboxd crew. First time, long time. When I think of editing Oscar winners, I think of crazy, fast-paced, quick-cutting movies, not unlike EEAO last year. But then movies like The Banshees of Inisherin get nominated, and that is a movie with more long takes of people sitting in a room and what seems to be very little editing needed. All this is to ask, what goes into the Academy's decision to nominate a film for Best Editing? Hey, I had that same question after Bohemian Rhapsody won. Ooh, okay, AJ, take it away.
Well, I mean, we could get into a bigger discussion about what the Academy is, who the Academy is, and why things like Bohemian Rhapsody win. But if I can slightly adjust to the question, is what would I think would be an awards-winning edit? It is, again, it is pacing, it is fixing, it is matching the director's vision. And sometimes that can be long-ass takes where nothing happens, and that's still editing.
But also, I mean, you keep saying like it's the closest job with the editor, or sorry, with the director, and that is, I think, why Banshees gets like linked in, because that's up for Best Picture, it's up for Best Director. It's like, it's so entrenched within that film that the five films that get into Best Film Editing are generally considered the strongest contenders for Best Picture, because they seem... that's how people view it. And to the point of like, why did John Ottman win for Bohemian Rhapsody? It's because there wasn't a director there. He became the director in the editing room. That is why he ended up winning. Even though everyone makes fun of how it was edited, it was very much like, thank you for saving this movie from someone who just fucked off.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. Yeah.
That's it. Boom.
Thank you, AJ, for the editing expertise. We have similar coming-of-age editing movies. Mine was Kill Bill Volume 1. Nice. Shout out, Sally Menke. Stick around for Winner, Winner, Chicken Run Dinner, because now we bring you our conversation with the editor of one of AJ's four favorite film edits of 2023, Jennifer Lame of Christopher Nolan's Oppenheimer. Yeah, so we usually start with one question up top with our guests, you know, to break the ice. But in honor of Christopher Nolan's approach to timelines, we are going to break the ice at the end. So we're going to start
with
something else. Yeah. We do things a little different here at Best in Show.
Oh, my God, okay.
So, you know, the Barbenheimer phenomenon. It was actually kind of a family reunion for you because you worked with Nolan and Baumbach. And so we do have to ask, was Greta in the edit bay too for Frances Ha and Mistress America?
She definitely would come by, but she was actually, they were really good about like, she didn't micromanage or needle or anything. She kind of like, Noah directed it, she wrote it. She would weigh in if she cared, but, and she would actually have a really great, relationship with her performance versus the fact that she was also a writer-producer. So she was kind of great in that regard. And then I've never worked with her as a director. I have gone to her, like I did go to screenings of Little Women and Lady Bird and like talked to her about her films, and she has a, like, obviously she's so hands on and like, you know, very deep in it. But I think with, you know, she's really good at compartmentalizing and keeping a healthy relationship, I think, creatively with that kind of stuff. So yeah, she would be in the edit room, but it wasn't like overwhelming and stuff. And she was always working on her own projects.
I mean, those are my favorite of Baumbach movies, actually, those two collaborations. What were your thoughts on the combo of those films, Oppenheimer and Barbie, and perhaps, you know, maybe these folks are friends of yours, getting that type of event movie co-launch? It was very, very unique.
Yeah. I thought it was so magical because I feel like both of those movies hit something for everybody, which is why it became this phenomenon. And then I also found that it also kind of had a great crossover, like where the Barbenheimer thing kind of came about, where it's kind of like everyone was interested in both. I was worried it would become a like, I'm a this person or I'm a this person. But I actually found, and especially with younger people, because I was working at a company at the time with like a lot of people, people were really excited about doing that double feature, which I was so relieved by because I didn't want it to become kind of this like us versus them thing. And I think with Chris and Greta and Noah and that, they both kind of have, I think they both have interesting personalities where you kind of, they aren't too specific, that they are a little mysterious, but they are also, they're both mysterious, but also kind of make movies for everybody. So it was kind of perfect that the two came together, I thought. It was really great.
Let's go back even further, because we're switching up timelines here. So yeah. What are some of the films that made you want to become an editor? Like, do you have any editing heroes?
Oh, man. I mean, when I was younger, I used to watch a lot of like Alfred Hitchcock movies, which I mean, I don't think when I was young, I was thinking about editing, but I liked the way that his stories were. I liked, and it's funny now that I get to work with Nolan, I feel like there's similarities in the sense that the movies kind of work on a level where they're for the like everybody and like for the masses and for the cheap seats and for people that just want a cheap thrill. But then they also, you can really overanalyze them and like get into the weeds of some weird fucked up psychology or some weird shit. So they can kind of work on two levels. And I think when I was younger, I really became obsessed with that. And then as I, like, you know, when I got older, like, you know, I love Nicholas Roeg movies, like editorially speaking, those were, I was just very into those movies, and like musicals I loved. And, yeah, there's just so many, I think as I got started getting into editing, I started going in deep into that world. But yeah, I've always just been like loved older movies. Like when I was younger, even though it's not very PC now, I remember like my dad took me to a film screening of Gone with the Wind. And I was like, whoa, this is crazy. And I kind of liked the theatrical nature of it, but that also was kind of like very emotional. And I was like, how do they do this? It's so weird. Like, I know these are all costumes and this is a set, but like I feel something. So yeah, I think I just always liked the kind of magic behind it all. And then the magic that I liked became editing.
So now we can finally start getting into some oppie talk. So were there any film structures maybe that you looked at for Oppenheimer inspiration? Because it's such a unique structure that I haven't really seen in a lot of films before. So I'm curious if you looked at anything.
Yeah, no, I think like what I learned from especially working on Tenet, just getting to know Christopher Nolan's personality is that I think he really likes you, especially in my job, coming to things very honestly and cleanly. Like, I purposely didn't read the book. I purposely didn't do any research because at the end of the day, my job is to make a movie that works for so many different people. And like, obviously a lot of people are coming to see this movie that have never seen the book, don't really care about Oppenheimer. You know what I mean? Like, so I think my job is to kind of get in that headset of, you know, completely no knowledge or, I guess a better way to say it is, I think with him, I don't really like to think of film references. I like to just get into it and use the script as my complete guide. I mean, I definitely watched Amadeus, I think, when I first read the script, because it just reminded me of that. I know that's a film that Chris likes. And, but again, the structure is very different from that movie, but that kind of just reminded me of it. And Chris mentioned it a couple of times, just like certain character relationships. But yeah, this the use of the black and white and the use of the way he did the timeline and how it kind of merged and then diverged is just, it's so unique. There wasn't really much to compare it to.
Well, I loved how the framework was kind of very like informed by fusion and fission. And
I know, I love that.
Yeah.
And it's not easy to catch. Like not everybody catches that. So I love that you're bringing that up. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Oh, but I love
that you're bringing that up.
I mean, it starts with those words on the screen, but in my second viewing, I was like, oh, now I understand kind of everything through the, of the pace and the visuals, how they are matching up with the divergent concepts. And it was kind of a lovely convergence. Speaking of Nolan, much like Dunkirk, with that ticking clock, I heard an interview with you where you'd like set a timer for 30 minutes at a time to assemble certain cuts of this, of Oppenheimer. And that feels like a spiritual reason for you to work with Nolan. Can you talk a little bit about how you work together and how that stopwatch approach to editing was beneficial? Was it just something you needed to do or is it a good process for you?
Honestly, it was just something I forced myself to do because I came on late to this movie. And typically, you know, the editor is on when they're shooting. So you have all that time while they're shooting to put the movie together. And I didn't have nearly as much of that time. So I kind of just did it because Chris, when he left me, I met Chris for one day after he finished shooting. I came in and he was like, I want you to just go through all the footage and just watch all of it. But I don't think you're going to have enough time to put an assembly together. So just like familiarize yourself with the footage and I'll be back in 4 weeks. And I think I did the timer thing because I just wanted to, I really wanted to try to do an assembly because that's, for me, the best way to watch the footage is to just play around with it. But I didn't want to not do what he asked, which is watch all the footage. And the worst thing is he comes back and I'm like, I have half an assembly and I haven't seen the second half of the footage. So I mainly just timed myself every day and I kind of did the mathematics of like, okay, this is how much time I would have for every scene if I just need to get through the end. So it was weirdly just my thing that I did to myself because it was a weird situation, but it is funny, I guess, yeah, that I'm working for someone who's very into time. But he was actually being really relaxed about it. And because he was so relaxed about it, I think I became like militant about it. The fact that he was like, just watch all the footage and do what you can. I was like, what? And then I became like really obsessive. But I'm sure if he had done the opposite, if he had said like, I really need an assembly in 4 weeks, I would have like messed around and pulled all-nighters and like not organized my time well at all. So it was kind of that weird thing.
Yeah, I mean, and it's especially hard to put together because the timeline is so fragmented and it meets out like jigsaw pieces of information before finally kind of zooming out to show the completed puzzle. And I'm curious, like, is non-linear editing, is it a bigger challenge or is it not as hard as it looks? Because like I can't wrap my brain around this gargantuan task that you not only completed, but just knocked out of the park.
Oh, that's so nice of you to say. I think for me, I had an amazing team. And what I'll say about like the two teams I had on the Nolan movies is like, they're such hard workers. They're so funny. We have the best time. And yeah, when I came on, they were so supportive. And yeah, I would get to scenes that would play out two or three times in the movie. And I would, we'd have to cut like really quickly be like, okay, I need you to organize this for me. And do so it was a huge organizational task. And just coming up with ways to organize the stuff so I could wrap my head around it. And when Chris wanted to see a scene, I knew, okay, they shot this version of the scene this way. But I kind of already had that skill from Tenet, kind of having, I knew that on every, like, I've only worked on two Chris Nolan movies, but my first assistant on Tenet had worked on, I think, like six or seven before me. And he said, every movie, there's going to be a thing. There's going to be a new challenge. So I feel like after Tenet, I was bracing for what the challenge was going to be in Oppenheimer. And then I was just like, okay, this is what we need to do. Like, this is how I have to organize it. But it was a huge organizational thing that a group of people definitely helped me with.
Yeah, that was the part that I couldn't wrap my brain around was the organization aspect.
It's a lot of talking, like talking about how to best organize it. Because you really need to talk out the best system. You can't just do it because if you mess it up, you only really have one or two chances to go through the whole movie and organize something before it's completely messed up. So it was just like a lot of talking of like, okay, what makes the most intuitive sense? So when we're working, if he's telling me this and this and this, that I can know where this is, you know?
Speaking of talking, you had mentioned in a podcast that I listened to that you love editing scenes of people talking in rooms. And I'm curious, like, why do you like working with dialogue so much as an editor?
I think, well, first of all, I talk a lot, if you haven't noticed. But I like talking things out. I just find, I don't know. I just, those are the types of movies I tend to love, just human drama. And I think also, you know, having my first start with Noah Baumbach, who writes incredible dialogue and incredible relationships. And some of my favorite scenes that I got to work with him, like in Frances Ha, you brought up that scene around the table where she goes to that, you know, she goes to that dinner. That was such a challenge, but it was so satisfying. We got it. And it's, that scene is so heartbreaking and funny and sweet. And I think that's where I learned, like, oh, a simple scene around a dinner table can like change everything in a movie. Like, how cool is that? And like, and I already knew that from other movies I'd watched, but I never knew that I would be able to accomplish something like that. And it felt so satisfying. And then, yeah, in Noah's movies, I got to do that so many times. In Meyerowitz Stories, there's that whole first scene where they're all eating dinner where you're kind of establishing all of their crazy relationships. In Marriage Story, there's the crazy conference room scene. There's a lot of scenes in conference rooms and tables that I love in Marriage Story. Like the Alan Alda scene is one of my favorite scenes. And then when Adam breaks down in that scene, it's heartbreaking. And so just the fact that in a small, empty room with no windows and one table and a donut crumb, you know, with Alan Alden and Adam Driver can make me cry. Like, how fucking cool is that? So it's just, I love that, you know?
Yeah, and I really love how you are so adept at working across all of these different genres, you know, like horror with Hereditary, and then as you brought up, Marriage Story, and then sci-fi action with Tenet. And is there like a dream genre that you would love to work on in the future?
Yes, comedy. I want to work. I always joke with Chris. I was like, I need to do a comedy. He's like, oh, I always joke that I've like kind of done comedy with certain movies. And he's like, oh yeah, that movie's hilarious. But like, I think Hereditary is hilarious personally. And I think because me and Ari kind of found humor in Hereditary, it makes it that much scarier. Like when she goes to that self-help meeting in the beginning and she starts telling the story of her family and everyone's like, wait, what? This is crazy. And one of my favorite scenes in Hereditary is actually the dinner table scene with her son when she flips out at him, which is another yes. table scene. I would love to do just like a big comedy. Like I would have loved to work on like the other, like Adam McKay, The Other Guys is like a favorite of mine. Like I just love, I would love that, but I have not been asked to do a big comedy.
Well, we'll call up Christopher Nolan and make him
I don't think he'll ever
change
do a comedy.
Into the comedy genre.
I think that's like a genre that scares a lot of, I think that's a really difficult genre.
It's so much harder than people give it credit for.
Oh my God, so hard.
I have actually only edited one thing ever in my life.
Oh my God, and it was a comedy?
And it was for Adam McKay's daughter. So, but the baby landlord, I was
Pearl? It was Pearl?
Yeah. My friend Amy Scott, who is an editor turned director, she, when I was just like kind of starting with some things, she was like, oh, you know Final Cut, right? Do you want to go to Adam's house? And like, I was like, okay, sure. And it was like, I put together like a homework and assignment with her. It was all her idea. I wasn't doing her homework.
Okay, but that's so cool. Her name was Pearl, right?
The yeah, landlord. Yeah, it's Pearl.
Give me my
yeah.
money.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Brian, I did not know this. You're keeping
Brian,
secrets.
Brian, I'm so jealous.
So yeah, I'll hook you up with
Is she
with
as that. Scary as she was when she was a kid?
No, she well, actually, I mean, that she, Pearl is the only director I have worked with, and she was very specific with what she wanted in her
Good
in her
for
assignment.
Her.
Yeah. But
oh
she was
God.
She was very nice to work with that whole family.
So
but
funny. Oh my God.
With tables. We're talking a lot about tables, but there are a lot of tables,
tables.
In Oppenheimer. Like, which was your...
There's a lot of tables.
Which was your favorite table Oppenheimer scene?
Oh, my God. My favorite table Oppenheimer scene. There's so many good ones. I'm thinking. I mean, Room 2022. I mean, I love that scene at the end between him and Jason Clarke where they just, like, go at it with each other. I mean, that scene was so fun. I'm trying to think if there's any like odd, weird table scenes outside of Room 2022 that I also loved. I mean, I love the scene. It's such a short scene when Kitty's like, I would have spit in his face. and she's like eating that nasty food that who knows if she made. And but yeah, I don't know. Maybe that last Room 2022 scene I thought was really epic. And everyone was just like giving it their all. And it was so fun to work on.
I love when they have to move the flowers away from the
kind
of war room
too.
Scene. Yeah.
Yeah. I have another question about favorites. So I have heard that your favorite character is Strauss or Straws,
Strauss,
as he likes Strauss, to be called.
Yeah.
And I really like that you've talked about how like you don't see him as a straight up villain and that you have empathy for him. And I want to hear your defense of our guy Levi right now.
Oh my God, yeah. I just feel like he's a guy who looks up to Oppenheimer and kind of wants to be him a little bit, and he's not. And I feel like he gets beat up a lot and he's always trying to do the right thing. And then he's just that classic character of like, then he exerts himself at the wrong time and doesn't exert himself at the right, like, and he does, obviously, with the shoe salesman thing, he has that Willie Loman kind of thing where you're just like heartbreaks for him a little bit, because I don't think he's an evil guy. I just think he got caught up in this thing. He got mixed up with this person he kind of became obsessed with, and he thought he could beat the system. And, you know, it's just like watching the movie as many times as I did, every time I see him being like, I have an idea, and every time you're like, no. And at the end, when he doesn't get the votes, like, my heart breaks for him. And he slaps his leg, and then he, like, can't help but ask who are the holdouts, because he's so, like, I made a joke. I don't know if I ever said it to Chris, probably, but I was like, he probably, like, when it was, like, JFK, he was like, I was like, I wouldn't be surprised if he had something to do with JFK's assassination, because he's so, like, he's so vendetta-based.
Yeah.
But, like, I just thought it was so funny that he couldn't help himself to ask who were, like, who the person was. And, but I don't know, I feel so bad for him, and I've just come to really love his character. And I think his character just is so human, you know? And Oppenheimer, at the end of the day, I think Oppenheimer, you know, we see human sides of him, and that's why the women characters are, like, you know, so incredibly important in that movie, and it wouldn't be the movie it is without them, even though obviously they're not the main event, but they make the main event. And I think that's where we see the human side of him. But I think in general, he is kind of this like godlike figure. And I think Strauss is the human who's like trying to battle with this person, and he can't, you know, and I think it's sad.
Yeah. And I would also be messed up if I thought that Albert Einstein didn't like me.
I know, so. Right? That's so natural to be like, yeah. And I love that he's so vulnerable that he's like, what did you say to him? Like the fact that he actually said that out loud. I love that about him.
Yeah. So you have this job that so many people would kill for, and it is to sift through like hundreds of hours of Cillian Murphy's beautiful face. was that ever like distracting for you? You also got to look at Robert Pattinson in Tenet. Like this is a little bit of a silly question, but I am curious about like...
No, it's a good question. And I feel like that's why I keep joking, because I've done a couple panels with like Ruth and Ellen and all the other like, you know, all the other big department heads. And I keep joking that the movie was every day when I went in was like opening a birthday present, because everything looked so effing good. And Cillian looked amazing in the makeup. And when he's young, he is very handsome with his crazy hair. And
I love his poisoning era.
But it's distracting in a good way, because it helped me infuse this like young, tortured person, because that's what he looked like. And if he looked like his age but with makeup on, it would just not be as interesting and distracting. So the fact that everyone did such a good job and everyone looked so great and it didn't feel period in a weird way, I was able to like really get in everybody's heads. And it was, Cillian was just addictive. You know, he was addictive. He was just drew you in, and he made me come back every day and work my ass off, which is hard on, you know, it's hard to spend a long time alone in a computer editing a movie. And he made it pleasurable.
No, I'm glad you brought up Ruth DeJong and Ellen, the costume designer, because as much flack as Christopher Nolan gets for like there aren't that many women characters in this, there are so many women production heads in
oh my
this
god
film.
Yeah,
yeah. And like his producing partner of his wife, like they're like, that's something that people overlook.
She's incredible at her job, by the way. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Jennifer, I'm so glad that you said that you would like to edit a comedy, because my question is, who is in charge of blooper reels on films? Like, not that Oppenheimer would necessarily have one, but like, have you ever made a blooper reel?
No, it's funny. I think it's kind of the assistant editors oftentimes do it, but I think, and they do an amazing job at it. But, you know, like on Wakanda Forever, I remember like there was a couple funny things, and I actually edited some funny thing that me and Ryan would joke about every day. I made a little comedy blooper reel for him because I had to leave a little bit early on that movie, and I sent it to him. I was like, Ryan, there's one last scene I want to send you. just to get your notes and thoughts, and I sent it to him. So I think, like, I have, if you're inspired, I think an editor does it, but mostly assistant editors do it. But if I find something that I become obsessed with, I definitely will, like, throw something together.
Yes. Thank you. I have been curious about this for so long. So that, yeah, that answer makes sense.
Well, the blooper already made the movie, which is Einstein's hat. That we love Einstein's hat. Just blowing off his head.
So funny. That.
Okay, so now we are getting to the point, the Nolan point, where we have to get back to the beginning when this is the question that
a
we usually...
A temporal pincer movement.
Oh my God. No. That is so cool that you said that. I can't believe you said that.
That's what we're going to do right now.
Usually this is our icebreaker question, but now that we're already friends, we can ask it as the closer. Jennifer Lane.
Yeah.
What is the first award you remember ever winning? Pre-film industry, if possible.
The first award?
Yeah. A ribbon, a trophy?
Oh my God. Wait, is this going to, like, you guys are going to know the answer to this question? No.
No.
Okay, that would be really, like, give freaky. Us your... If you, like, played me a video of me at, like, 5 when I was like, what?
Our master plan.
Yeah, that'd be so scary. The first award I ever won? Guys, I really don't know. I mean, I know I won an award in film school for my documentary I made, which I don't think I won a lot of things before that. And I was really impressed with myself. But it was so sad because it was for best documentary. And I think 2 people had made a documentary, like 3. And I was like, that sucks for them and me. You know what I mean? It's just awkward.
What was the subject? What was your documentary subject, though?
It was this guy who owned this weird store in Middletown, Connecticut, which is kind of a conservative town. And he wanted to build this epic mural on top, and like him and all his friends were these hippies and like stoners, and the town was like, you can't build that. It's like not part of the ordinance of the town building zone laws or whatever. And they decided to like fight the man, but they were all just like crazy and had no idea what they were doing. And I also just found bureaucracy so fascinating, you know, these people in the small town, like feeling like they're these big deal people, and they're so I filmed like the whole thing in the court case, and it was really, I found it very entertaining. Just to like follow these people around. And then yeah, that's when I became kind of obsessed with editing, because I had like 60 hours of film and I had to make it into 10 minutes. It was crazy.
Well, you are thanks for joining, because you are a big deal person now. We all were very excited to get you on this podcast.
You guys, this was the most fun. Oh. And I'm so jealous of you, Brian. I want to know more about that movie. Yes. We'll talk about that another time.
Before we get to the winners or egregious snubs that we have been watching this past week, this segment's namesake is finally out. Chicken Run, woo-hoo! Dawn of the Nugget. Bawk, bawk, bawk. Everybody be a chicken really quick. Brian, we're waiting.
Brian's holding back on his rooster.
He doesn't want to do it.
I haven't seen any chicken runs.
That's okay. You're just asking me to make a chicken noise.
Have you seen any chickens? Ever? Chicken? Oh my God. Brian, name a chicken.
Name one chicken for $1.
Name one chicken.
Name a chicken.
I can name a red jungle fowl. That's a chicken. I will name
can
chickens.
Can you make a noise?
Till the chickens come home. I will sing songs.
They're not
but
Pokemon,
I will not.
Brian. They don't just say their own names. You got to do the cluck, cluck, cluck.
Okay. He's really not going to block for us.
I'm going to do it. Here we go, Brian. This is for you.
10 out of 10.
Excellent.
That's a good one. Look, can I do a peacock? Because that's what I hear all day.
Of course. That's okay. Of course.
Go
of
course. For it.
Peacocks go.
You could have just said that was a chicken and you would have passed much earlier.
But the peacocks are divisive in my neighborhood. I am a defender of the peacocks, of the
peacock run.
Yeah.
Catch up with chicken. No, that sounds like an ad read. Okay. Well, Chicken Run 2. Hey, it's not called Chicken Run 2. Hold on. Chicken Run Dawn of the Nugget is on Netflix. I was going to watch it as a birthday treat with my friend right before my birthday party last weekend, but we didn't have enough time. So we watched episode 2 of Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip instead for some reason. But Gemma, it's not about that. You've seen it. What is your verdict on Chicken Run,
well,
Dawn of the Nugget?
Oh, here we go. Okay, so I watched the first 20 minutes of it with my son. I was so excited. Moo, it's on. Let's sit down and watch it. We got 15 minutes in and he goes, I want to go to bed. And off he went to bed. So then yesterday I pick him up from school camp and I'm like, let's go home and watch the rest of Chicken Run. And he goes, oh, we just watched it at camp on the iPad.
And on iPad?
Yeah, on an iPad. I mean, well, first of all, that's my problem, I guess, is that we have to watch it on Netflix at all. I want to see those clay chickens, you know, in big screen glory, but whatever. What's it doing? Currently sitting on a 3.2 average rating. Chicken Run, the original, has a perfect 3.5.
Perfect score.
Last time, those chickens broke out of a chicken farm. This time, they're breaking in. It's kind of, I know, it's kind of a reverse Barbie. In a way, it's funny that they've both come out in the same year because they go from this kind of like real life, quite bucolic, groovy, makeshift island that they now live
Wakanda
on.
Wakanda for chickens.
Pretty much. To a weird smoke and mirrors free range farm where all the chickens are unnaturally happy. And one of them, a little bit like up to the heavy side layer. I'm so glad I got a cat's reference in there. one of them gets chosen to go up the rainbow elevator into a happier life. And if you know, the title says it all. You're going to be a chicken nugget. So anyway, I don't know. It's nice to have Ginger and Rocky back and Bunty and Molly and Babs. Zachary Levi replaces Mel Gibson as the voice of Rocky. Honestly, how is that better?
So, so funny when they announced, like, don't worry, we're not getting Mel Gibson back. And everyone was like, good choice. And then Zachary Levi, the same week as, like, the announcement of his cast, we had that.
I know. I don't know. I mean, it's still Aardman. It's still the Aardman magic. But there's just something, I don't know, there's something a little off about the kind of the whole, you know, spectacularness of it. I like kind of more grounded, organic storylines involving these chickens. I'm not such a fan of the big production values, but good news for you, Mia. Mm-hmm. Nick and Fetcher are back. The rats.
My rat friends.
Yeah, your rat friends are back.
Yep. I love my rat friends from Chicken Run. I'm glad they made it to the sequel.
Yeah, and we know that Sam Fell is the director this time round. He did Paranorman, but he also did Flushed Away, which also, of course, features rats.
My beautiful rat husband, Roddy St. James. Oh, Aardman gives us the rats, and I'm grateful for that.
Yeah, so, you know, it's fine. It's fine. It's fine.
It's fine. Hey, and that's what I was expecting. So, well, now we can start talking about some historical awards contenders that made it into our Letterboxd diaries, right? Brian, Gemma, AJ. You know, AJ, let's start with you.
Okay.
Because you're our wonderful guest.
Yeah, I watched Watership Down a couple of days ago. I watched it because my flatmate, Pickle Darling, was opening for the band Bright Eyes about a month ago. And I went to see them. And me being, here's a fun thing about me, really music illiterate, like don't really keep up with music at all. I heard Bright Eyes and I thought, right, like the Art Garfunkel song for Watership Down. No one knew what I was talking about. So I started playing and listening to that. And of course, that leads to watching Watership Down, a movie which every kid is told in the 90s or early 2000s, it's really sad. You won't like it, basically, is what my parents... I loved rabbits when I was a kid, and it wasn't until I was 10 or 11 or 12 that my parents even let me watch Watership Down because they were like, it's very sad. And I don't remember too much of what I thought about it at 11 or 12, but watching it again now, it's so beautiful and sad, and it's I think paired with that song, with Bright Eyes the song, it's like a musing on death, on what death looks like, what death feels like, what death is going to be like. And it's weirdly comforting. I think you look at the lyrics of Bright Eyes and it's all the lyrics are basically like asking questions about what death feels like. And I think the movie conveys that.
Every time I see a dead rabbit, I just start singing that song and crying. It's just, yeah. It's got the multiple award-winning John Hurt in there as one of the voices. Mm-hmm. In terms of its awards prospects, it was nominated for the Hugo for Best Dramatic Presentation in 1979, and it won a Saturn Award. Winner, winner, Chicken Run dinner.
Yeah, so the Saturn Awards, we haven't actually brought up on this podcast before, but they've been around for more than 50 years, and they celebrate what everyone complains about is not celebrated enough at the Oscars, which is sci-fi, horror, fantasy, adventure, all those films. So it's genre films, and they've been doing it for long before people just like started calling them genre films. They actually used to be called the Golden Scrolls.
Ooh. Ooh, I quite fancy a Golden Scroll. AJ, thank you so much for bringing the Saturn Awards to Best in Show.
All what good. A baller move. And hey, Watership Down, not dissimilar to Chicken Run conceptually. So
it's so true. I thought a lot about it as I was watching that and, I know, Animal Farm. I watched, and sorry, Mia, I know you're going to scream, so maybe turn your levels down, the 2023 BAFTA and Oscar Best Costuming nominee and BIFFA Costume Design winner, Mrs. Harris, Goes to Paris. Starring Golden Globes, Best Performance by an Actress in a Motion Picture, Musical or Comedy nominee, and our favourite AARP Movies for Grown-Ups Actress nominee, Leslie Manville.
Yes!
Obviously, it's brilliant. It's the best cozy holiday movie. We were on a holiday. I was with someone who hadn't seen it before, and I was like, this is going to be the one. This is an easy one. There's just something perfect in this blend of workers' rights and high glamour. Love it. What about you, Brian?
I rewatched Cool Hand Luke, which won a Best Supporting Actor for George Kennedy. Paul Newman was also nominated, but he lost to Rod Steiger for In the Heat of the Night. The reason why I rewatched this was because, so during pandemic, especially during lockdowns, for about a year and a half, I ran a double feature club where friends would meet on Zoom. We'd pre-program. I would bring in journalists to program as well. Like Kyle Turner did my favorite programming. It was Safe. His was Safe in Evening Primrose, which is Anthony Hopkins singing in a warehouse store that he's sleeping in. It was a television production, but had great double feature pairings where they had to be paired by, they had to be linked by themes. We would meet every 2 weeks, watch beforehand, discuss them. It was a tradition that a lot of people liked, but then, you know, as we started going back out into cinemas, we stopped doing that. But people keep wanting to bring it back. So it was like, we'll bring it back for Christmas every year. And you're like, what does Cool Hand Luke have to do with Christmas? Cool Hand Luke is a Christ figure. He is.
Yes.
So the way that I paired it was with Three Godfathers, which is a John Ford, John Wayne Western of three outlaws who are on the lam, and they take care of a baby that from a dying woman. And basically, this child, taking care of the child, kind of redeems them. So they're kind of like the three wise men. And then Cool Hand Luke is the Christ figure. It's as cool as it ever was. So Cool Hand Luke, that is. Because we're talking about editing, I do want to just mention that, like, Sam Osteen edited this, and he's the editor I've seen the most this year. But actually, when you were talking about coming of age editing films earlier, AJ, I think the first film that I really recognized editing was The Graduate, which Sam Osteen did edit, and especially the seduction scene. The seduction scene in particular, when he's like looking away, looking at, and I was like, oh, well, I have not seen this before when I was younger. And that was the first film that made me aware of editing. He edited Cool Hand Luke, and he did a very nice job. It's always nice to revisit Cool Hand Luke. I kind of feel like I haven't seen any of the Chicken Run movies, but I know that they're informed by The Great Escape, so they're probably informed by Cool Hand Luke as well.
And they both have eggs. They're both.
Oh, yeah.
Eggs are pivotal in both 50, films.
50 eggs.
Is this segment just, can we connect the last thing we watched to Chicken Run? That's my understanding of it.
That's just kind of how I live my life.
That's the new rule. That is the new rule. That's the game. At four episodes in, it's taken a guest to identify the rules of the
Welcome
game.
Welcome to the Chicken Run show.
Well, Mia, and I brought up The Graduate. You love Mike Nichols. Throw into you. What have you been watching?
So I saw one of the editing greats, Lawrence of Arabia, in 70mm at the newly reopened Egyptian Theater in Hollywood. Real quick, I went into the courtyard to run around during intermission of this 228-minute epic and ran into Chris Pine. That made me really hyper for the rest of the movie, and that's all I could think about for the second part. But anyway, it's not about that. It is about our Twinkie buddy Lawrence, and he is number 79 on Letterboxd official top 250. Lawrence of Arabia is also featured on Martin Scorsese's list of top 10 widescreen films, and Here we go. It won 7 Oscars at the 1963 wow. Academy Awards. Clean sweep. Some of these were Best Picture, Best Director for David Lean, and of course, Best Editing for the legendary Anne V. Coates. Woo! Anne has edited over 50 features, including Steven Soderbergh's Out of Sight, and Aaron Brockovich, and David Lynch's The Elephant Man. And okay, but this is my favorite. Her very last film that she edited of her career was 50 Shades of Grey.
Out of Sight is the sexiest movie ever made.
Yes.
Thank you, Anne V.
Coates. I agree. Thank you, Anne V. Coates, for your service.
Talk about whipping a film into shape.
Ooh. Thanks so much for listening to Best in Show, a limited award season series brought to you by the Letterboxd Show. You can follow our whole crew and our HQ page on Letterboxd using the links in our episode notes.
Speaking of crew, thanks to our guest, video editor AJ. Thanks to Slim for making us sound amazing. That's editing as well. Sophie Shin for production. George Finnick for newslettering. And Letterboxd member Trent Walton for that music.
And as always, thanks to you, Brian, for your editorial expertise. And a quick reminder, our year in review is just around the corner. It celebrates the best of the year's films, according to you, the Letterboxd community.
Yes, everyone gets to vote here at Letterboxd. We calculate all member ratings up to midnight on December 31st for the complete picture of the year in cinema. Oh, and make sure to pick a good movie for your final film of the year, too. I've settled on a 35mm New Year's Eve screen of His Girl Friday.
Nice.
So if you want to know your opinion was counted, take a moment over the holidays to go back through your diary and make sure all of your ratings are up to date.
The Year in Review is released in the first week of January 2024, and we will have a special episode of Best in Show out on the same day in between now and then. We do have another episode dropping featuring John Batiste. Oh, there's just so much going on around here. Is it the holidays yet? Can I stop and have some Christmas eggnog?
Best in Show is a Tape Deck production.
We got a lot of clucking in this one.